apprenticeship program based around here. She had a good reason for wanting a lot of young engineers around. This is the closest point to the site where I want to put our main fortification, Carmella confided to me mid-afternoon after she had given her four men their assignments for the day. We really need something big, strong, and permanent if we're going to win this war, or even run it properly. Didn't you hear? We're not at war. We have a treaty, I pointed out humorlessly. I heard. I don't believe a word of it. The only reason we aren't knee-deep in goblins right now is because we eliminated a goodly portion of Sherul's frontline army last year. He's wounded, but he's rebuilding his strength. Within 5 years there will be another horde coming out of the Umbra. Unless there is a ship strong enough to survive that wave, these little towers will be for naught. How big are you thinking? I asked, curious. The rock I want to set it upon lies in the northeast from here, back between Ragnar and Salik, to the east. It is massive, a nearly cube-like block of granite that used to be a mountain, before most of the soil and substrata fell off. The western end juts out over the base by at least 300 feet. The top can be reached by the eastern side, which trails down at a gentle slope. It's right in the middle of a broad plateau, perfect for agriculture, and it's difficult to get to. Really, Min, the place is perfect for a real fortress, she said enthusiastically. How big, Carmella? I repeated flatly. How big does it need to be to resist Sherul? I think we could take the keep 5 stories, the towers at least 7, large enough for 5,000 men if we build it properly. That's a big castle, I said, shaking my head, and not one that I've budgeted for. But you think we need a big castle? Think of it this way, Min, she proposed after a moment's thought. When that big army does come marching out of shadow, like we both know it will, where will it go? Depending on where it starts, down the timber road to the cotton road, thence into Gilmora, I offered, or along the east road into northern Castile. Either one would be a catastrophe, she agreed. So, let's give them something to attack, something they'll have to attack, something so strong they dare not leave it behind them, something so tough they'll have to spend armies on it, but something so remote that it won't matter if they lay waste to the countryside, something so big that if they don't attack it, it will turn around and attack the Umbra itself, something big enough to withstand dragon fire, she added finally. That's a very big castle, I said, nodding. Big castles are expensive. Ishi's tits. Little castles are expensive. How expensive is invasion? She countered. I had no answer to that. I knew a castle could be built. It was just money, and I appreciated her strategic thinking. But what Carmella was suggesting was a great undertaking, something along the lines of Relancor or Darkfaller. A castle that large would take years to be completed. Some fortresses were never completed if money or will ran out. But Carmella also had an important strategic point. Having something in the wilderlands designed to be attacked by the Gavanni hordes, sparing the brunt of the thrust from the heartlands, appealed to me. Having a hardened fortress close enough to our forward positions to support them and act as a depot and reserve made a tremendous amount of strategic sense, which also made it unlikely for the king to consider. He was trying to reduce his commitment to the Al-Shari front, not increase it. I promised Carmella I would consider it. I had Dara and her riders take a day and go fly off to take a look at the site. She was no expert, but she was a good artist. I had her make several sketches, including one from the air. Meanwhile, we had more refugees, particularly more kids, coming in every day. All sorts of outlandish rumors got spread, from how I was leading them to a land of honey cakes and berry tarts, to how I would conjure magical armor for everyone and go fight the Goblin King. It was said that I was giving new clothes and shoes and money to every child who came with me. I had good work in secure quarters for all at my lands in the east, ran another. I was going to found a monastery and teach my magic to every child, to build a mighty army of war magi, ran another. It was all kind of ridiculous, and the more ridiculous the rumor, the more people wanted to believe it. That was understandable. Desperate people are desperate to believe in what they want most. Thankfully, the Kasari were level-headed enough to dispel most of the outrageous ideas before they got out of control. And Brother Hotfoot, as the unofficial organizer of the new refugees, was adept at explaining the rules and the situation to newcomers. Some people went home bitterly disappointed that I wasn't tossing purses of gold to any and all. But that didn't stop them all. Particularly the children, who seemed to arrive in a constant stream. I was on my way to the latrine one morning when a young refugee girl, about 9, her new dress clearly from the quartermaster and a bit too big for her, stared at me intently as I walked by.
"Hey," she called. "Are you the spellmonger?"
she asked suspiciously. "I am," I nodded warily.
"True that you're going to marry all the girls? That you want more wives?"
That took me aback. No, not true at all. I've got a wife. She looked at me skeptically.
"I heard that you were going to choose the prettiest girls to marry yourself. I just wanted you to know. I don't wash dishes."
"You don't wash dishes," I answered, confused.
"No, I bloody don't,"
she insisted in her adorable Wilderlands brogue.
"I'll do laundry, I'll cook, I'll clean, but no bloody dishes." "As long as that's clear, I don't care what you do,"
she conceded. I will take that under advisement," I agreed. She nodded firmly, as if we had come to some arrangement. I nodded back. I had no idea what the hell I had just agreed to, except that she wasn't planning on doing any dishes. The refugee children were adding an increasingly wild element to the orderly march. Part of that was the sheer number of them coming in now, about 12 a day, and part of that was the difficulty convincing them that they had to live by our rules, after living nearly feral in the forests. Some had formed little gangs, and were now loath to give up their associations in favour of the Kasari patrol system. Brother Hotfoot instituted a transitional patrol, a kind of training program, after the first 2 days at the riverside. New kids who wanted to be included in the march had to spend 3 days learning the rules before they were given any equipment, though we fed them. Once they could prove that they could behave themselves for 3 days, they were assigned to an existing patrol as a kind of apprentice. The problem was that the patrols were expanding to 15 or 18 kids now. That forced the older kids to get together and reorganize the system all on their own. They ended up creating 20 new patrols, spread out over the troops, mixing the native Kasari with the refugees as much as possible. They did this all on their own, without consulting any of the adults, and the Kasari Rangers accepted their decisions without question. "It seems a little odd to let the children decide for themselves how they are organized," I pointed out to Arborn at breakfast, after he informed me of their decision. He and Pentandra had come by to eat and discuss organizational details when the patrol reassignments were announced. It was a little disconcerting to be informed matter-of-factly that I was losing 3 of my patrolmen by a 12-year-old girl with a roll of parchment and an authoritarian attitude. The boys were reluctant, but they didn't argue. They had their assignments. They started to pack up their bags and said their farewells.
"The best way to teach is to invest them with the responsibility and encourage them to think ahead,"
Arborn replied reasonably.
"We've been training them to think like that since they were 6 years old. Assuming authority and making real decisions forces them to hold themselves accountable for their mistakes, and being well organized is the essence of preparedness," he said, as if quoting a proverb.
"I suppose I just don't expect that kind of initiative from children," I decided. "Narasi kids are taught to obey and to wait for instructions, usually with beatings if they're slow to comply. I've never seen a Kasari adult raise a hand to a child."
"Nor will you,"
Pentandra said, her hand desperately close to Arborn's. This march had seen her maddeningly near to her beloved, but unable to express her desires in the way she was used to, in the slightest of ways. Yet anyone with eyes and a shred of understanding could tell she was smitten with him. For his part, if one was canny enough to see behind his stoic exterior, and instead paid attention to where his eyes lingered, Arborn returned her affections. To do more would have been against the Kasari way.
"The Kasari don't punish their children that way. They are central to the culture,
and a lot of their civilization is dependent upon their focus on their children.
I've noticed that, I agreed. It just seems a little obsessive, from my perspective. Children are our legacy, but to make their nurture and education a culture's primary focus.
It's far more sophisticated than that, Penny assured me. I've been studying this. The culture emphasizes personal honor and responsibility to the point where the focus on the interior development of the children's character keeps the Kasari from becoming warlike or competing for resources outside of their groves. The Kasari simply don't see anyone who hasn't undergone their rites as worthy of competing with. You can't argue with their competence and effectiveness. Can you imagine how ruthless they'd be if they applied that expertise toward being soldiers?
I've seen them in battle, I agreed, recalling the first Kasari I'd met during the Farisian campaign. But they don't even have a warrior class, exactly, I pointed out.
That's right, she agreed. All Kasari can fight, to an extent, but few train to fight, exclusively.
Arborn explained one reason why the Narasi have historically had problems with the Kasari.
The Narasi are led by their warriors, whereas the Kasari are led by the wisest of their elders, selected for competence. The warriors are subsidiary to the council. Some have never been in battle, so the Narasi have a hard time respecting them, whereas the Narasi glorify battle and warfare to the exclusion of much else in their leadership. When one of the Kasari elders, who specializes in, say, medicinal plants, comes to bargain, they don't take her seriously. Conversely, the Kasari have a hard time respecting the Narasi idealization of warfare.
I can see the Kasari perspective, I agreed. The Majocracy promoted people based on magical talent and political connections, which made you easy pickings for the ignorant warrior culture of the Narasi, I pointed out helpfully.
It was our own fault, Penny agreed gravely. We spread a rumor that the Majocracy sheep were more shapely and elegant south of Vor, and the Narasi didn't get the joke, she shot back.
Arborn eyed us both with a mixture of amusement and surprise.
This is why the Kasari will always endure. We have contended with both Narasi and Imperials for centuries. You offer a choice between war and mystery, massacre and magic. We Kasari will keep to our groves. We will stay focused on our legacy, in our children, he said, finishing a biscuit.
So, you don't have any children, do you, Arborn? I asked casually, knowing he didn't. I never got around to really asking.
No, Minilin, he
said, his face suddenly stone.
I have not added my name to the lists of those seeking mates. Perhaps soon, he
said, pointedly not looking at Pentandra, who was glaring at me so furiously I feared a magical attack. I highly recommend it. If you find the right girl, I said, hoping to salvage something for Pentandra. I hadn't meant anything by it, really, but in retrospect I suppose it wasn't the best topic of conversation.
How does your tribe go about such things? Just curious.
Okay. Perhaps I was enjoying this just the tiniest bit. It will depend upon the sorting ceremony, he said woodenly. A Kasari man who wishes to wed must submit his name to the council and be accepted to the rites. Through the 7 days of the marriage rite, he proves his worthiness to be a good husband and is instructed in the crafts of marriage. After consultation and discussion, the council will pair him with a complimentary Kasari bride whose skills, character, and temperament match his the best, he explained.
Apparently this was news to Pentandra, whose eyes shot open. Suddenly, she wasn't looking at me anymore.
I thought that one had simply to complete the Kasari rites, she protested. I thought that once a girl became initiated, or whatever, that she was free to marry.
Aye, Arborn agreed reluctantly. But inside Kasar, that decision is made by the bride, the groom, and the will of the council. If they do not think that the match is a good one, they will assign a different mate.
Assign? A different mate? I asked, suddenly amused.
Even if Penny did complete whatever mysterious tribal ritual she was required to, she might not end up with the muscular Kasari ranger she wanted.
Ishii must be having a tremendous amount of fun with this. Would the council really disapprove of a wedding?
It has been done before, agreed Arborn quietly. If the needs of the community are not served, if there are doubts about the compatibility or the character of the proposed couple, if there is a disagreement as to the bride and groom, either can petition for a better match, or withdraw. But they can only withdraw once, before they are restricted from the right.
That's unusual, Penny said, struggling with words, and clearly troubled. What about love? What about passion?
They are not requirements for good marriage, it is said, Arborn replied, a little guiltily. Such things are considered, of course, but it's complicated, he said finally, shaking his head. I never thought I'd see Arborn squirm.
So it seems,
Pentandra said quietly, withdrawing a little.
Arborn, they wouldn't deny a match so clearly intended by the gods, would they?
It's complicated, he repeated uncomfortably. Mating is done with the good of all Kasari in mind, not just the bride and groom. Some Kasari stay celibate their entire lives, for many reasons. Others have large families. Each match is judged in context of the whole council. If it seems doomed, or one of the two are not adequately skilled in housecraft, or the union would present undue problems, then yes, it could be denied.
That's very interesting,
Pentandra said, in a way that sent a bit of a chill up my spine.
And just what criteria are used in determining skills in housecraft?
Cooking, cleaning, laundry, sewing, spinning, weaving, churning, wood carving, baking, shearing, skinning, dyeing, curing, salting, singing, drying, accounting, planning, husbandry, horticulture, gardening, childcare. The basics,
Arborn shrugged.
The things needed to run a house. But you needn't worry, he said, in a low voice only I could overhear. You excel at all that you do. I have every confidence that you would do very well in the competition, and that there would be no undue obstacles,
he said, rising and walking away.
Lucky bastard. I had to stay and clean up the metaphorical blood.
Did you hear that?
Pentandra whispered to me, a shocked expression on her face.
The fact that your future happiness might depend entirely on what some tribal elder raised in the forest might think of you, and your ability to churn butter, weave cloth, or change a nappy?
I asked, waiting for the inevitable volley of ire, or possibly magical death. Pentandra relied on servants or magic for most things. I had never seen her pick up a needle in her life. It was funny. Penny, Alia, and Dara, the three women closest to me, all hated needlework. I wondered if that meant anything.
No, that he has confidence in me, that he wants me to take the rights. Min, I've been hinting around for weeks now, but that was the first tangible sign that Arborn is supportive of me pursuing him.
And you aren't worried about the competitive element of the rights?
I asked, surprised. There were an awful lot of young, pretty Kasari maids, I'd noticed. Probably some better at, say, churning than Pentandra. Her eyes narrowed.
I might not be able to bake a pie, Minilin, but I've been competing against other women my entire life. And as Arborn said, I excel in all that I do.
Without saying anything more about it, she got up, brushed off her rustic gown, and strode determinedly back to her camp. She managed to do it with just the right element of feminine grace, and a hint of hysterical compulsion. My throat was suddenly dry. I felt sorry for any woman who decided to vie with Pentandra for Arborn. When she has that look, she's committed.
Chapter 19. The March to Tudri. We named the final tower Eastguard Tower, as it was the southeasternmost ward of the line, and sat overlooking the escarpment. During the initial invasion, the region 60 miles east had been the main route of the goblin advance to the escarpment. During the advance, they'd gutted towns and slaughtered every village in their path, until they got to Timberwatch. They just as easily could have attempted the descent here. But Eastguard Tower overlooked the escarpment and the rest of the vale. The men could keep watch over that road to the west, and the devastated lands in the east. It could support vulnerable Lendeen and provide refuge to any escaped slave who made it across the southern portion of the Wild Water. More, it also put a loyal garrison in a region that had grown its share of outlaws and rebels to authority. That was important from a political standpoint. A strong ally here could only help Duke Angwin in his quest to reconquer this land. It was a fascinating process to watch. Angwin's magical visit at Midsummer had inspired an interesting effect on the march. The Kasari had been cautiously open to the young man and understood that his cooperation had been granted for their transit. They were grateful and respectful of him, if cautious. The Narasi refugees had clung to any display of traditional authority adamantly, and meeting with the highest lord of the realm had been akin to a divine visitation. Half of the adult followers boasted of meeting their liege in the wilderness, when I knew full well that less than half had been present at Angwin's tower. Eastguard was our final construction, and it grew with the ease of experience and practice. The hill over the river was slight, a mere 200 feet above the riverbank, but it was broad, nor was it uninhabited. A tiny abbey survived on the southeastern side of the hill, and there were at least 2 freeholds nearby. Nandine, reduced in size to a mere 400 souls, was nearly thriving after 2 years of relative peace. The design for Eastguard was simple but elegant. Carmella followed the earlier plans, though she proudly proclaimed she had refined the technique considerably since her first peel tower and wanted to experiment a little. Once the site was prepared with earth elementals and defining ditchworks that ran to the river's edge, I brought the Karshak in from Sevendor and set to work one last time. Foundations were laid, halls were staked out, a spring house was dug. The site wasn't nearly as pretty as Angwin's tower, or as defensible as Sarik, but Eastguard ended up being a handsome little castle on a smart little hill. One of the major elements of the tower was the fortified bridge over the river. That took 2 days of Rondal's attention. He spent it splashing around the river with a crew of sturdy Kasari boys, securing footings in the riverbed to build piers sturdy enough not just for a bridge, but for a blockhouse with portcullis and such. Once the planks were laid, the western bank was accessible. As she had at the other towers, Carmella's crews also took the time to lay out a village site, wells, and cleared around 80 acres of overgrown country for crops. The broad slope of the mounds provided excellent drainage, but the soil was only moderately suited for agriculture. Still, that many hands preparing the place for living built more in 2 weeks than an average Wilderlands village could construct in generations. As the tower's basic form neared completion, and the bridge was roofed over, and a small guard tower added over the far end, we held our final naming ceremony with the installation of the glass globe in the elegant tower overlooking the escarpment. We also began the process of figuring out what to do with the adult refugees. I didn't want to keep them with us. As it was, we were employing more than 50 as guards for 3 meals and a penny a day. Many of those had fought at Ragnar Tower against Lady Mask, but we didn't really need them as mercenaries, this far away from large Gavani concentrations and so near allies, and some of them were unhappy with the poor conditions. I was a soldier once. I could understand. Eastguard Tower needed a garrison just as much as any other tower did, and our plans for this particular tower were grand. 25 acres of land around the structure were included within the earthworks. 2 large halls, stables, and a temple were being planned, in addition to a garrison hall. The goal of this tower was to attract escapees and runaways from the penumbra, to give them a beacon of hope and a reason to desert their foul masters. And, as Carmella had suggested, it could be a place for the talented to learn some useful skills for future endeavors. From here, the former slaves could be fed, clothed, strengthened, and sent on to Tudri, just a few dangerous days down the road. The Iron Band planned a presence here at some point, but I wanted something more regional in character to handle day-to-day operations on behalf of the Hessian Order Mage, Mistress Marsden, who we were installing here. Marsden was a stubborn old bard
who was raised in a mercenary camp before she came into her talent. She specialized in static defensive spells, the kind that slowed down armies and broke them in sieges. She was an ideal commander for a troubled region. But she needed a garrison to command, and I had mercenaries I didn't want to see become bandits. To that end, I set up a full company of men-at-arms, recruited from among the refugees, turned guards, and sworn to protect Eastgard. Any man who volunteered for a 1-year stint got 4 ounces of silver as an immediate bonus, courtesy of Lady Mask's pay chest, and then 1/2 ounce of silver per week, every week of service, as livery. We hired women to run laundry and cooking services for the garrison too, and paid a decent wage. While not ideal for grain, the lands behind the tower were sparsely wooded and could be made into pastures and perhaps corn or bean fields. I was hopeful about the possibility of an entire new settlement arising around Eastgard Tower. The garrison was important for other reasons, too. Most of the Wilderlords who made up the region's professional military had been killed in the invasion. If Anguin wanted to hold the province, he needed troops, troops loyal to him. I made certain that the men I hired understood that they were in the service of the Duke, after Mistress Marsden. I instituted rituals and policies for the place to emphasize both their attachment to the Alshari ducal house and protecting their lands. I had the local abbot of Mostel administer the oaths and swear himself to hold them accountable for them. It was a crude start, but important. For one thing, by being ducal troops, officially, it kept them from getting embroiled in local disputes. Neither could they be ordered about by even a baron. Their standing orders were to garrison the castle, rescue refugees from the penumbra, guard the bridge, and follow the orders of the Duke and his chosen officers, starting with Mistress Marsden. The Eastgard Tower Company was thus formed, and a banner depicting the antlers of the ducal house hovering over a white tower, Carmella insisted on whitewashing the exterior of the place for effect, was commissioned. They weren't particularly good troops, I knew. Worse, even, than the army of mercenaries I'd once hired at Tudri. But we found a few veterans among them, made them ancients, and organized them into watches and patrols under a crusty old woodsman who had been in 3 campaigns against his lord's neighbors in his youth. Most were peasants or woodsmen, driven from their homes and holdings by the invasion. Few had seen organized battle before their service at Salik Tower, but nearly all had fought for their lives. They lacked training and discipline, and for the moment they lacked appropriate arms. I was able to scrounge a few older swords to go along with the spears and hounds I'd gathered, but there were still not enough for everyone. I promised more weapons and real armor as soon as I could procure some. They were content for now to drill with staves, trading out real weapons for duty. There were rogues among those, too cowardly to fight and too lazy to farm. Some had been bandits even before the invasion, or had used the excuse of social disorder to walk away from debts, or cover for other crimes. I didn't want them following us. They were the sort you had to watch around the kids, but I couldn't exactly command them to stay, either. Instead, I hit upon the solution of forming a company for them. They were lazy and cowardly, but they knew how to brew, some of them, and they all knew how to drink. I made use of an abandoned small holding 1/4 mile from the bridge on the western bank, and quartered them there. I gave them a kettle, 6 bags of barley to malt, and 2 casks, enough to begin the business of brewing. Carmella was skeptical when she heard my solution. "You just made the closest neighbor to a peeled tower into a taproom," she chided. "See what an excellent wizard I am," I teased. "Do you have any idea what that's going to do?" "Give the garrison some place to drink and spend their coin," I answered. "There are worse things, Carm. I put it on the far side of the river on purpose. If those scoundrels want the garrison's protection, then they'll have to bend to the garrison's rules. Its second purpose is to serve as a lure to those poor souls enslaved in the penumbra. A man might risk his life for the chance of freedom, but the chance of freedom and a beer? I expect this to be a busy place." "Which brings me to my third reason," I continued, before she could object to my first two. "This region is more densely inhabited than the wilder areas north we cross through. Notice how many more survivors have gathered here? There are enough people to consider re-establishing some sort of real order. If Trousalan can thrive, this place has even more potential. We're mere days from Megalyn. And an alehouse will be a beacon of civilization? You're going mad, Min. Most of these folks, lords, went off and got killed in their defense 2 years ago. Then the goblins burned everything they could burn. This region is a wasteland. Now that things have settled down, a taproom is a sign of commerce, a portent of order, and a symbol of normalcy. It will also soon become a hub of gossip, rumor, and real news. You'll place a lot of store in a barrel of ale and a hovel, she said doubtfully. It's human nature. Who knows? If the ale is good enough, it'll attract the goblin clientele too. Think how much effort that would save in intelligence gathering. She called me devious, which I felt was a compliment. Carmella is very good at what she does. I've never met a better siege engineer, but she doesn't appreciate the wider scope of war magic. I was learning that there was more to war than swords and soldiers. Intelligence was a vital part of the equation, and right now we knew precious little about what was going on in the penumbra. I saw that nascent tavern as an important strategic asset. Besides, it kept the ruffians out of the castle, where they could cause trouble. That only left 100 or so adults who insisted on coming along with us. That many was manageable. For the most part, they had adopted useful jobs with the march, assisting the medical troop or the construction troop, or were simply restless and wanted to see where the march was going. If they agreed to follow the rules of the march, I did not bar them from travelling with us, at least as far as Tudri. Since that was generally south and away from the penumbra, it seemed a good place to travel for many. We tarried at Eastgard Tower for 10 days before we set out again. The days were long and hot, the weather was clear, and I wanted to make as much progress as possible while we could, before the autumn rains came and turned the roads to mud. With our numbers swelled to 3,286 now, according to Sir Festaren, keeping our momentum going was important. Once Eastgard Tower's bridge, garrison, and magically glowing orb was behind us, we made remarkably good time moving west, over the escarpment and toward the security of Megalyn Castle. The roads were little used, but still in good repair in most places, and we were able to march 4 or even 6 abreast. The giant hawks wheeled overhead, in front and behind us as we marched. The inevitable complaints of the newest marchers were drowned out by the Kasari marching songs, and we did better than 20 miles that first day, and the 2 after that. Though we passed through more abandoned and burned-out settlements, we started seeing more intact, too. I tried not to stop the march unless we needed to, and usually stopped just long enough to present our credentials, ensure that the Lord of the Land was willing to pay at least nominal loyalty to Duke Anguin, and keep us from being attacked by jumpy men-at-arms. Not everyone was happy with our transit, however. Some were openly scornful of the Kasari. Unless they threatened action, I let them be. Few were willing to start trouble with so many Kasari bows in evidence, but the grumbling from some rustic lords was severe. It rose to the level of a response when an ugly little yeoman at a crossroad demanded a toll, 1 penny for every child, 2 pennies for every Kasari child. The rangers didn't beat him. They let the youngest Kasari children tie him to his pike with hundreds of knots and left him at his post with a single penny for us all. I'm sure he had a friend somewhere who would come untie him. He seemed a friendly sort. The country south of the escarpment felt like rural Alshar of old, the wilderlands baronies I'd come to love as much as my native riverlands. The rivers and the diminishing reach of the goblins had kept it relatively safe. Baronial castles had held out in most places south of the escarpment and east of the Wildwater. Raids had been fierce in the early days, but once the Gavani had turned their attentions to Gilmora, this region had resisted the sporadic attacks from the penumbra. The guards were wary and well-armed, and the wardens suspicious when we approached frontiers, but otherwise, life continued here much as it had before the invasion. Unfortunately, many local lords saw our march as a means of evacuating the refugees who had gathered in this relatively safe zone. As our company marched through a land, the reeves of the domain would sometimes push their unwanted folk behind us. Sometimes they were sent with a few gifts to encourage them on their journey. Sometimes they were beaten with staves until they followed. But in 4 days we'd accumulated an excess of 400 more people, mostly adults. We couldn't feed them, really, but they clung on to our scraps and foraged, much as they were used to. Luckily, the summer months find the wilderness lush with fish and game, and these were woodwise folk in their way. We kept pushing south, and I let Brother Hotfoot deal with them. We got even more children, too, including some pushed along by their own parents, like the beggars. Times were lean in the wilderness, and a magical march to a fictional happy ending was too good a hope to pass up for those who'd listened to their children's hungry whimpers all winter long. I felt miserable as I saw the enthusiastic new recruits being taught the basics of Kasari customs, because in fact I had no real idea where they would end up, or what would happen to them, and that was starting to weigh on me. I wasn't the only one worried about that. As we approached the outer frontiers of the former barony of Megalin from the north, word of our advance had spread down the road ahead of us. At a little hamlet called Yellen, a force of 100 men-at-arms stood against the pathfinders when they arrived, barring their approach. They were armored wilderlands fashion, with swords and round shields and coats of plate, and the three wilderlords who led them wore mail and carried lances. Their leader got into a heated debate with Tyndall and Arborn, until I was called forward to speak to them. Sir Haldan, Sir Owasi, and Sire Gand all stood off against Sir Tyndall, who was continuing to argue with them, as Arborn looked stubbornly on, and his rangers took positions along the flanks of the column. "Permission to proceed, as I said, without hindrance or toll, through any domain so sworn to his seat. That includes this domain," he insisted. "Master, perhaps you can speak wisdom to them," he said, his voice heavy with frustration when he saw me arrive. The fact that he hadn't attacked them already demonstrated how much my apprentice had matured. "You are not leading that rabble through our lands," Sire Gand insisted. He had the bushy moustache that wilderlords preferred, like the one Sire Kay affected. It was streaked with grey and arrogance. "My lords, I am Baron Minilan of Sevendor. As my fellow has undoubtedly informed you, we have the Duke's own permission to proceed through these roads to Megalin Castle," I said smoothly. "I have all of our documentation right here," I said, patting the case at my belt. "Everything is adequately spelled out, signed and sealed by the hand of His Grace." "The last we heard, Duke Lengwin fell at Timberwatch, Baron," Sir Owasi said suspiciously, leaning forward on his horse to spit. "His son has been properly confirmed and invested by the Coronet Council," I informed him. "Long live Angwin, Duke of Alshar. Now, gentlemen, are you going to let us pass, or are there going to be complications?" I asked in a friendly voice. "Regardless of whatever parchments you bear, or their seals," Sir Haldan said menacingly, "the Kasari are well-known enemies of the realm, vagabonds and rebels. Permitting them free access through our country risks our security." "We are just passing through, gentlemen," I soothed, "by the expressed wish of His Grace, who also had the foresight to make me a Marshal of Alshar," I said, a harsher tone to my voice. "Now, you can let us pass unmolested, or you can defy the Duke's command and be named rebels, your lands forfeit. I await your decision," I added patiently. "And just who do you think would enforce such a ruling?" Sire Gand asked, with scornful amusement. "You lot! Baron Minilan of Sevendor, called the Spellmonger and Company, at your service," I said, bowing. "Perhaps you heard of me, from the Battle of the Lantern, the Battle of Timberwatch, the Battle of Cambrian. I helped slay a dragon in that one." "He directed the slaying of a dragon," Tyndall corrected, unhelpfully. "Other people actually slew." "There was a dragon," I assured them, irritated at my apprentice. "It was slain. I was involved." "Regardless of your campaign history, and I'm sure it is a worthy and noble one," Sire Gand said sarcastically, "we know too much of these rope peddlers and vagabonds. It is not rebellion to police your domain of vermin. Arborn and the Kasari did not respond to the insult the way a bunch of Narasi would have. There was some angry stirring at the Wilderlord's insult. But Arborn shouted out, "My scout in Gifelshar," and made the Kasari sign, and they quieted down. But they also became far warier. "If the Duke desires it, then it is," I corrected him softly. "I ask you one last time, gentlemen. Yield the road or face the consequences?" I didn't draw my blade, which would have amplified the tension of the moment. We weren't at a point where I would threaten violence directly, but we were getting close. They made it very appealing, too. Siagand regarded me stubbornly. "I have fought all my life to preserve this land, the land my ancestors bled for and were buried in its bosom for 6 generations. With honor and sacrifice we have tended its soil. Why would I dishonor their memory and stain the soil by permitting such filth to pollute it?" There were nods and grunts of assent from the other two. "You dishonor it more by having your land and titles stripped from you." "Very well, Sir Haldon, Sir O.R.C., and Sire Gand, as you will not comply with His Grace's edicts, I hereby name you rebels to His Grace, and in the name of Anguin of Alshar, do now reclaim the titles to your estates and holdings. Further resistance shall result in your arrest and detention for your rebellion." The three knights looked at me, gape-jawed. "You've got to be mad," chortled Sir O.R.C. "You take our lands? You have an army of children behind you," he scoffed. "Not a horse or lance among you." "These children just built 7 castles in 2 months," Tyndall said, shaking his head, amused by their lack of wisdom. "They can all shoot, too. Better than you can." "You would wage war on children?" Arborn asked the knights, contemptuously. "We would keep Kasari vagabonds out of our lands," Siagand said, finally drawing his cavalry sword. "If a few of these brats get bloodied, or their necks stretched to keep the others off, it won't trouble my sleep. These are our lands." "You don't have lands anymore," I reminded him. I reached out to contact my other apprentices, mind to mind. "Your swords, gentlemen. Don't compel me to use force."
"You are mad. I'll not hand over what is mine to some strange riverlord with a pack of beggars at his back. Turn around and head back north. That is your last warning," Gand snarled.
"Sir Tyndall, do me the favor of seizing these men," I commanded my apprentice. "They have refused the lawful order of their overlord and shall therefore see his justice."
"Gentlemen, your swords?"
Tyndall asked, reluctantly drawing his mage blade.
"My scout in Gertais." "Come and take them," Sir Oasi called arrogantly, drawing his own.
Arborn was bidding the children in the closest patrols to stand back, but a number of them were stringing their bows instead.
"All right," Tyndall shrugged. "I did give you the opportunity to surrender."
He reached his hand into the air and made a motion, whispering a word under his breath. Sir Oasi's blade was torn from his grasp and flew to land next to Tyndall's foot.
"Sorcery!" accused the outraged knight.
"Psychokinetics, if you want to be technical," Tyndall said,
kicking at the blade as the other men advanced on him. He made another motion, and Sir Haldon made a strangled cry as his elbows refused to obey his commands any more.
"Do I have to bind you, my lord, or will you lay down your arms?" he asked Sire Gand. "You think a wizard's trick will keep my men from slaughtering you all?" he asked, angrily waving his sword at me.
Darrow chose that moment to land all 8 of her wing of giant hawks and falcons in a circle around the men-at-arms. The giant hawks loomed over the Wilderlords, who struggled to keep their steeds from panicking. Every man there suddenly felt like an underdressed mouse in a field under the hungry eye of such gigantic predators.
"Depends on the trick," I replied smoothly.
"You are overmatched, gentlemen, and your own prejudice has earned you a hard sentence. Your lands and titles are forfeit. Do not compound your folly by thinking a glorious death will redeem you somehow. It might just make you dinner." There was more grumbling, but in the face of such opposition there was little the trio of lordlings could do. I was sympathetic to them, a little. They were trying to impose some order on their ravaged lands,
and 3,000 children tromping through upset their ideas of order. But that didn't excuse their backwards ideas about the Kasari. I disarmed all three and insisted that they pledge to return to their homes, settle their affairs, and report to Tudri, a mere 60 miles away, for judgment by the Duke or his magistrate. They grudgingly agreed, promising a vigorous defense in front of his grace, when their day came. But they let us pass without bloodshed. That didn't happen the next day, when we came to the bridge over the great deep Ardams River. The lord of the closest estate, Lovay, had closed the bridge to us, and no matter how much we threatened and showed credentials, he fired on us. In volley. 2 dozen of his archers let fly against the pathfinders as they approached, and 4 children were killed. 6 more were wounded. Tyndall had to be persuaded from blasting the bridge to rubble. Once again I came forward and tried to discuss my credentials. They shot another hail of shafts. I detonated a thunderous explosion over their heads for spite and withdrew. I was angry at the deaths, but I didn't want any more. The Ardams was only about 30 feet wide in this region, but very deep and tumultuous. After consultation, the Kasari assured me they could lash together a temporary wooden bridge to bypass the stone bridge guarded against us. It took them an afternoon to build a construction of poles to span the river, with supports and a walkway sturdy enough to hold all our weight to cross. We had 50 husky lads haul it into place, with some magical assistance, about 1/2 mile upriver. The war magi snuck over as soon as it was in place, and at dawn the rest of the march proceeded across without difficulty. I led the war magi. I was angry. Those kids had been entrusted to me, and they'd gotten killed because some petty lordling couldn't be bothered to talk before firing. Arborn and 1 score of his rangers came along. The Kasari aren't big on vengeance, but they feel powerfully about justice. We hit them in a surprise early morning raid, striking them from behind and by surprise. The Skyriders peppered them with bolts from above, and while they writhed in turmoil, Tyndall, Rondal, Ormar, and Landric struck in a devastating series of war spells. Alchemical smoke covered the bridge with noxious fumes, while bolts of magical force racked the warriors guarding it. As the men ran out of the smoke, they ran into a series of stunning spells and other disabling enchantments. If they struggled, Landric put them down efficiently with the flat of his big pole arm. The Kasari held their fire on any who laid down their arms. Those who tried to fight were shot dead. I picked through the moaning bodies as they struggled against the spells that bewitched them, until I found their commander, a young Wilderlord in a richly embroidered surcoat, bearing a device with a dog and a bear. I picked him up by the belt, and threw him into a clear area, as my men sorted out the survivors. "Who gave the command?" I demanded when the knights were conscious enough to respond. "Who gave the command to fire upon children?"
I did," he gasped, as he coughed and choked from the sulfury smoke he'd inhaled. "Who are you?"
"Baron of Sevendor, Marshal of Alshar," I said dismissively. "You killed children I'm responsible for. That makes you answerable to me."
"I was defending my land against an army," he gasped, struggling to get to his feet. "We've heard about this rabble Kasari army for weeks. I was not going to let them imperil my folk."
"They're not an army," I said patiently. "They're a peaceful relocation of children, which you would have learned if you had deployed your wisdom as quickly as your bowmen. But now you have committed this crime, and while it may have been a mistake, there will be consequences."
"We will not have the Kasari in our lands," the knight said, pulling himself to his feet. "The last thing we need are those vagabonds skulking about."
"They're marching through, not staying," I said as patiently as I could. "But your stupidity has forced us to tarry. We have funerals to conduct now, and you have dead children to answer for."
"They are not my concern," he said angrily. "They had no right."
"The Duke himself gave them the right," I interrupted. "Are you of better rank than he? You've proven yourself a witless fool. What is your name?"
"Sire, Hafos of Perans," he said,
brushing his long hair out of his eyes. "Here on behalf of the Lord of Lorvay."
I find it hard to believe that the Duke gave leave to march an army of Cassari through these troubled lands.
I'm guessing you'd find it hard to believe a great many things, Sire Hafos, I replied. That is not my concern. You've done grave injury to these people, and it will have to be answered for. You gave the order. The responsibility lies with you. He hemmed and hawed about it, but the steely-eyed rangers around him made him nervous, as did the looks of contempt from my war magi. Eventually he conceded that he'd acted hastily, unwisely, and that he did indeed have a responsibility for that. Had he persisted in his belligerence, I would have made more of an example. As it was, he'd lost 9 men-at-arms in the attack. Others were wounded. It was a harsh blow, not just to the man's power, but for the security of the area. I left Sire Hafos with a warning not to interfere further with our progress and a summons to appear before the Duke at the next convenient court to answer for his actions. I had no idea if Anguin would even be holding a court near the man any time soon, but it was sufficient enough threat to get him to do as I wished. It did nothing to soothe my mood, however. The weight of those kids' death was a burden on me. There were no more incidents as we passed through the district and south into the outskirts of Tudri. We could have stopped at Megalin as planned, but the brushes with the Wilderlords had compelled me to hurry our pace. Summer was more than half over, and there were still hundreds of miles to go on our journey. The Megalini Knights did give us an escort for the last several miles, to avoid any more unpleasantness, thankfully. Bendenald the Outlaw came forth with a score of knights, and rode with the main body all the way to our next destination. We encamped around an old temple to Huin, I recalled, in the area, setting up the camp in the green meadows that had borne witness to a great battle a few years back. There was little sign of the invasion now, thankfully. There were crops ripening in distant fields, and peasants dutifully mowing the meadows for hay. The mound where the dead had been buried lay covered with scrub in a field outside of the town's wall. But that was all. Apart from the number of horsemen patrolling the region, it looked much as it had the first time I rode through the town years ago. Tudri was an important milestone in our journey. It marked, roughly, the halfway point between the Cassari homelands. But from Tudri, we should be able to travel more quickly over the roads. Once we were over the frontier to Castal, there was a direct route north and east that ran nearly straight to the only city in Cassar, Lemsiddens. That was when the children would be safe, really safe. But Tudri marked the auspicious halfway point, and I wanted a few days to rest, mourn, and celebrate. What I didn't anticipate was the 1,000 war orphans who haunted Tudri deciding, as a group, to include themselves in our march. Word had spread down the road ahead of us, word of the spellmonger's great march of children. It didn't matter where we were going or what we were doing. Every orphan in town wanted to come along and be part of the magnificent quest. If there was room enough for the ones who had come along on the march, there should be room enough for all, ran the reasoning. They came out to our camp in a mob the morning after we arrived. 1,000 ragged-looking, mostly barefoot children were excitedly running across the meadows, invading the camp and interrupting breakfast. The Cassari didn't really know what to do. These Wilderlands children, in some ways, were worse behaved than the kids we picked up along the way in the backcountry. They had been living in abandoned buildings in Newtown, the parts that hadn't become barracks, and doing what they could to survive. Some had heard of the things we required for the march and presented their own knives, hatchets, or boots, likely stolen in most cases. Many thought that the equipment in camp was free for any to take, which sparked dozens of fights between the Cassari and the refugees. Others were determined to go on a grand dragon-slaying adventure with the famous spellmonger, far from the smelly streets of the ugly army town.
"There are 1,000 of them, Min," Penny moaned, as we contended with the chaos. "We can't take them all."
"How can we not?" Brother Hotfoot asked, as he pulled the 5-year-old urchin out of a pot of porridge. "Look at them. Many are even worse fed than the poor souls we found in the forest. If they are able to make the journey, how can we leave them behind?"
"Because we don't have any bloody place to put them," I answered back, sharply, more sharply than I intended.
The kindly old priest had been adept at organizing the refugees,
a real asset to the march. But my point was valid. Once we get to the other end of the trail, what do you think the Kasari are going to do with 2,000 more children than they planned on?
The gods will provide,
the priest supplied unhelpfully. Monks are always saying crap like that. Of course, I happened to know a god, a goddess. I tried to think about how she could help, but nothing sprung to mind. I resolved to have a quick prayer with her as soon as I got this situation under control. I could at least use some inspiration. Kids were everywhere, fighting, shouting, arguing, crying, laughing, playing. I had to put a stop to it. I summoned a cantrip I usually reserved for serious distractions in battle. I wasn't sure it would be potent enough in this situation, but it was worth a try. I cast it high overhead to get the maximum coverage I could. A peal of artificial thunder rang out as a large vacuum was magically created, and then allowed to be filled in an uncontrolled implosion. Every kid there froze.
Hold!
I called, magically amplifying my voice. All troops in formation! Now!
My skeleton ved!
There was an instant scramble as all the Kasari children and their recent recruits sorted themselves out around their individual banner poles. The refugee children looked on in wonder and confusion. I'm sure it seemed magical to see children responding with such order.
The rest of you, form up around the tall knight in the meadow,
I commanded, indicating a startled-looking Sir Festaren. He was on the far side of the encampment, away from our gear, and that's where I wanted these urchins for now. The orphans moved sluggishly and without order, but with a little persuasion from rangers and war magi, they moved back away. Some were getting angry about being denied the fulfillment of their individual dreams, but most were curious about what would happen. I realized I had a decision to make. I looked out at a sea of orphan faces and realized that the decision was already made. I could see the faces of Minalian and Almina in each boy and girl. I could not leave them behind, when these other children would get the benefit of opportunities these kids didn't have. I knew what would happen to them if they stayed in Tudri. If they didn't die of disease or starvation, that is. The girls would quickly seek protection from men who would ill-use them. The boys would form gangs for protection, and slowly kill each other off in petty disputes until they found a noose or conscription. A few would escape to temples or apprenticeships, but war orphans rarely ended up at the end of happy tales. If you will all listen and be willing to obey the instructions, we can get to work determining if you can qualify to accompany us, I instructed, as I walked to the space between the neatly organized, mostly, Kasari, and the mob of orphans. Any child who fails to comply will be excluded from consideration.
What are you doing, Min?
Pentandra asked, mind to mind, as I found a place from which I could be seen by all as I addressed the children.
We can't take them all. We discussed this.
We started to, I agreed. This changes things. We can't leave them behind. We just can't. She didn't complain anymore, because everyone was looking at me expectantly. I took a deep breath. I stepped off the cliff into madness. All who qualify for inclusion in the march must commit to following the Kasari way, but no child who does so will be left behind. I realized quickly that I was bellowing authority without establishing who I was. For those of you who don't know me, I am Minalan the Spellmonger. I saved Tudri from the goblins 3 years ago. Now I'm back to lead you all to safety, but only if you are willing to do as I say. There was a cheer. Thanks to Astaral's governance over the town, my name was well known and highly respected in Tudri. But with that cheer, my fate was sealed. The nature of the march changed. Suddenly, we weren't just building towers and escaping the penumbra. Suddenly, we were saving the orphans of the Alshari Wilderlands. The fact that I had no idea where they would go, what they would do, or who would care for them, was beside the point. I was committed. Chapter 20. The Origins of the Kasari.
I really appreciate you taking 1,000 street urchins off of my hands, Minalan, Astaral said casually as he poured the wine. I'm looking forward to the drop in street crime and petty theft, and I have you to thank. We were having an impromptu council meeting in my pavilion in the encampment on the grounds of the temple. I'd asked him to bring some. Kasari culture be damned. After the day I'd had, I needed wine like a flower needs the sun. I didn't need Astaral's sarcastic attitude.